It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and it is Purim on the Jewish calendar.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. It is Purim. If you're not familiar with Purim, just read the book of Esther, and that'll give you the historical background. And then over the centuries, this has been a time of special celebration in the Jewish community of Purim plays, people dressing up as various characters. And of course, there is the hated Haman, who wanted to exterminate the Jews, who becomes the prototype of all those through the ages who have risen up to exterminate the Jewish people and who themselves have been judged by God and sometimes judged by their own nations. If you've got a Jewish-related question, so Hebrew-related question, question about Jewish tradition, question about messianic prophecy, if you have a Jewish-related question, give me a call, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Question about Israel today. By all means, give me a call. I noticed this comment was posted on Facebook, within the last couple of days. And unless it violates our guidelines, I'm sorry, on YouTube, unless it violates our guidelines, we allow the comments to stand. So doesn't matter if it's erroneous. If it's erroneous in terms of speaking lies about a group of people in a destructive way, that's one thing. But if it's saying something false or wrong about me, you know, whatever, we just unless it's some type of absolute character attack that's ugly or slanderous, you know, we let things stand. So this one Jewish guy is attacking a video where I respond to one rabbi who had refused to debate me. And he ends by saying this, Dr. Brown, I can bet with you that you speak no Hebrew and do not read Hebrew and know nothing about vowels, past, present, and future tense in Hebrew like I do. I do not care about any translations you read. It is enough for me to see how you talked about the Alma case, meaning Isaiah 7:14, and you do not know what it means. And he has in Hebrew, Hal Maharav Yoledet Ben. He actually left out two letters in his quote there. Have a great day. Now, this is the kind of thing that I would gladly respond to if I responded to comments on social media and say, buddy, you have an error in your own Hebrew. You left out two letters from Isaiah 7:14, and you're telling me I can't read Hebrew. But this happens day and night, and you let this stuff stand and let God separate truth from error. But the sad thing is, you want to help people, you want to inform them, you want to educate them, you want them to grow in grace and knowledge of God, or to be confronted with the truth. And when people are just resistant, when people are just mocking, when people despise the truth, when you give it to them, what can you do? You just pray. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. You know what I'll also do? If you post your question, Jewish-related question, on our YouTube chat, as we're back up with our live feed now, if you will post your Jewish-related question, I'll answer some of your YouTube chat questions as well. Purim comes from the word for lot, the casting of lots. And if you'll read through the book of Esther, you'll see the origin of the term there. There are other expressions that can be used in Hebrew for casting lots, but that's what it goes back to in the book of Esther. Let me speak to this phenomenon for a moment that Esther reminds us of. The book of Esther is the one book in the Bible that does not have the word God in it. Does not have the word God. So you're talking about a book in which God's activity is massive. where God is clearly actively involved to save his Jewish people from destruction. Waking up a king with a dream, having different types of intervention and things like that. There is no question whatsoever, that God is involved, but he's not explicitly mentioned by name in the book of Esther. This is really, really interesting because it often speaks of life as we live it. In other words, that in an ongoing way, God is working and God is involved, but he's normally not doing it in a visible way. He's not doing it in a way that anyone can see without faith. Now, when you look at it through the eyes of faith, you see God working and moving in all kinds of different ways. And I don't just mean that we talk ourselves into it. Well, it rained today, so God must have sent the rain, and there's a miracle because it wouldn't have rained, and I prayed for rain. Well, yeah, we were expecting rain today. Maybe that wasn't a miracle. But there are plenty of things where God intervenes in ways it gets our attention. We recognize the hand of God. There's no question that God is involved, but it is not visible. Doesn't it tell us in Hebrews 11 that by faith we understand that the visible things were created by that which is invisible, and that the heroes of faith were moved by faith? They believed what God spoke. They believed what they felt in their hearts was coming from God. They believed the word they received. They acted not based on sight, but on faith. And because they lived by faith, they then saw the results. If you believe, you will see. When the mockers speak to Jesus hanging on the cross, "Come down from the cross that we may see and believe." Gospel faith is you believe and you see. Now, God will work during the ministry of Jesus. God performed certain miracles to draw attention to him, that he was the Messiah, that he was the anointed one. And through this now, people came and they heard and they believed. And to this day, God powerfully backs the preaching of his word to demonstrate that Jesus is risen from the dead, and yet it is still an act of faith to put our trust in him. And as we put our trust in him, then we see his hand at work. So in the book of Esther, again, the one book in the Bible that doesn't mention God by name, there is pronounced and clear divine activity. Not only so, but there's the famous verse in Esther 4, where she's saying, "Look, if I go stand before the king without him inviting my presence, I could die." And Mordecai, her cousin, her older cousin, tells her, "Listen, if you don't stand up now, then deliverance will come from another place." And that is often taken as a hidden reference to God, another place, meaning God himself will do it in a different way. And whatever the origins of this term, the word "the place" is used as a name for God in Orthodox Judaism. He is called Hamakom, the place, in Orthodox Judaism. Just a YouTube comment I want to comment on. There is an absolutely horrific, miserably erroneous, terribly ugly video by Pastor Steven Anderson called "Marching to Zion." At one point, I would like to do a series of videos rebutting it, but there's so much error in it. There's so much that is ugly. There is so much that is terribly misunderstood. There's so much that even incites hatred for the Jewish people that it would take a bunch of videos to demolish the lies there. I just mention it because it is referenced by a gentleman named Alex Bell there on YouTube. Sir, don't be misled by that garbage. It is the standard anti-Semitic nonsense garbage. Always you mix in a little truth. That's the satanic way. That's the way of the devil. But Pastor Steven Anderson is not to be trusted. He is also a radical King James-only preacher, and he has advocated death penalty for homosexuals and other things. So we absolutely disassociate from his views. And yes, I know the video has been watched a lot of times. That's the way it's going to be with anti-Semitic lies. They will spread. They will multiply. And listen, if you think there's truth to that video, then have the courage to call me and tell me what you think he's right about. pick up the phone and give me a call, 866-348-7884. By all means, if you've watched it or you're confused by it, you have questions, give me a call. Bottom line is this. There have been attempts to wipe out the Jewish people in every generation. This is something going on. This is Satan's work one way or another. Now, the most effective thing that the enemy is doing is assimilation. Not extermination, but assimilation. So that what you have happening consistently over and over and over again is Jews leaving any connection to the God of Israel, leading any connection to their Jewish past and completely assimilating into the rest of the world. I don't mean becoming followers of Jesus Yeshua and then giving themselves to reach the lost in the nations and being part of the larger body of Messiah, the church, the Messianic congregation. I don't mean that. I mean Jews simply losing connection with the God of Israel, completely assimilating into secular society so that their kids have no clue that they're Jewish and the next generation completely lost to it. That's another effective way to separate them from their historic calling. Adolf Hitler tried to exterminate. Others have tried to exterminate. Under the Catholic Church, Jews were exiled, banished from countries where they weren't baptized. So we know in America in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Well, what does a traditional Jew know? In 1492, all non-baptized Jews were expelled from Spain. And that's not the only country where this happened. So these are things that are well known in Jewish history, and yet Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live, not because of our goodness, but because of God's purpose, not because of our holiness, but because of his holiness, not because of our faithfulness, but because of his faithfulness, because we have been called for a purpose. Pray with me that the lost sheep of the house of Israel would find their divine purpose in the Messiah, Jesus Yeshua. Pray with me that the lost sheep of the house of Israel would rise up and fulfill their destiny and be a light to the world and make the God of Israel known and welcome the Messiah back to Jerusalem. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. A whole lot more to talk about today. Purim on the Jewish calendar. A bunch more things to cover with you. Don't go anywhere. Got a couple of reminders, some important announcements I want to share with you as well when we come back right here on the Line of Fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. One thing that I want to address today, we're in the midst of Purim Festival. Again, if you're not familiar with that, read the book of Esther for the historical origins. Now, I want to reply to some questions that have been coming in on our YouTube feed. I normally don't do that. We'll have our team looking at the chat and letting me know about things that are important. But today, I'm glancing over. If you're watching, not just listening on radio or podcast, but if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook and you see me glancing over, I'm looking at our screen. So I'm going to get to some of the YouTube questions as well. But to call in, 866-348-7884. I've often addressed the issue of what's called replacement theology or supersessionism, the idea that the church has replaced Israel in the purposes and promises of God, or that the church has superseded Israel. Now, when I had a friendly dialogue with Dr. Gary DeMar about this, he said, look at the word ecclesia. It just means congregation, assembly, and it was used for the assembly of Israel in the Old Testament and for all believers in the New Testament, so there's no such thing as replacement theology. Well, and I appreciated the point he was making. The larger issue is this. If, when your theology is all said and done, you have a viewpoint whereby there are no national promises that remain for the Jewish people. It is replacement theology. You have taken promises that were explicitly given to the people, to the nation. Say the promise of the land, which God reiterates in Psalm 105, was a promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob long before there was a Sinai covenant. And Paul tells us in Galatians 3 that the law, which is 400 years after the promise, cannot annul the promise. So the promise that God would give the land to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which you can identify as the ones who were scattered, the ones who were judged, the ones who've been all over the world, the ones who've been brought back, all right? And DNA tests would largely confirm ultimate origins and where we come from. But aside from that, it's easy enough to trace history. It's scattered here, scattered there, literature written there, and then regathered here, regathered there. It's easy enough to trace these things back. But bottom line is this. If you end up with a theology that says that those promises that were given to physical national Israel, promises about rebuilding of Jerusalem, the prayers that Jerusalem would be the praise of all the earth in Isaiah 62, that now means the church, that means something spiritual, that means something heavenly, it is replacement theology, and it is to be rejected. A question was asked on YouTube when Paul is so emphatically clear at the end of Romans, the 11th chapter, that even though Jewish people for now may be enemies of the gospel, their love for the sake of the fathers, for the gifts and calling of God, are irrevocable. And that's why Paul promises that there'll be a national turning with the return of the Messiah and that all Israel will be saved. Speaking about not just the remnant, certainly not speaking about Gentile believers there, whom he refers to elsewhere as Gentiles and references the fullness of the Gentiles, but speaking of those who are now hardened, that they will turn at the end of the age. How can replacement theologians be so secure in their position when Paul's so blatantly clear? It's a mystery to me. I understand the arguments. I tried to go that way many years ago, but couldn't successfully because of the clear testimony of Scripture and the clear action of God in history along with that. Some say, no, we are into fulfillment theology, not replacement, but fulfillment. So all the promises of God are yes and amen in Jesus. They're all fulfilled in Jesus. He didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill. And therefore, all the promises that God gave to Israel find their fulfillment in Jesus, the epitome of Israel, the one who accomplishes the goals of the nation of Israel. So Jews in Jesus receive the promises, but Jews outside of Jesus do not. Well, same end result. I agree with much of that. And of course, Jesus, Yeshua, fulfills the destiny and purpose of Israel. Of course, I agree with that. Absolutely. And yes, Jews outside of Jesus are lost. If a Jewish person dies rejecting Jesus the Messiah, that person is like anyone else that dies rejecting Jesus the Messiah, lost and under the judgment of God. There's one way of salvation for Jew and Gentile alike, and that's through the blood of Messiah. That's through his death and resurrection. It's that simple. If you could be righteous by keeping the law, then the Messiah would not have died, all right? So, very plainly, very clearly, no dispute here that we need to share the gospel with everyone, to the Jew first, also to the Gentile. There's no salvation outside of Jesus the Messiah. That's what I've lived for 46 plus years, and that's why I'm rejected by so many in the Jewish community. That being said, God has still made promises that hold for the nation as a whole, that he would scatter us in his anger and he would regather us in his mercy. He has done that. That he would sprinkle clean water on us back in the land. He is doing that. That there will be a national turning at the end of the age. He will do that. Once you take passages like Zechariah 12 to physical literal Israel and say, well, no, that has another explanation or another fulfillment, now it is a form of replacement theology. So you can call it replacement theology, you can call it fulfillment theology, you can call it whatever else, it is all the same. Let me also say this. It is this theological error in church history that opened wide the door to anti-Semitism and persecution of the Jewish people. There are people who hold to these theologies today who are not anti-Semitic. They don't have an anti-Semitic bone in their body. But they are convinced by Scripture that all of these promises now apply to the body of Christ as a whole or to anyone in Jesus and no longer to Israel as a nation. And that's what they're convinced of. I'm just telling you that historically, it is the doctrine of replacement theology that opened wide the doors of anti-Semitism and Jew hatred in the church, which is a principal reason that Jews don't turn to Jesus, because the church did such a good job of pushing them away through the centuries. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Lloyd in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire. All right, something's funny with that connection. We'll have to check on that. Let's go to Lewis in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
I had a question about Jews, which I'm not a Jew, I'm a Christian, but I've been kind of studying the Sabbath day, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering, once Jews, if they're considered a Messianic Jew, do they start to lean more towards a day of Sunday being their worship day, or do they still hold to the Sabbath?
It goes either way, actually, Lewis. There are many Messianic Jews who come to faith in a church like I did, right? So you come to faith in a church setting, and Sunday is a day when everyone gathers to worship, and that becomes kind of a Sabbath rest day. You don't do normal work then, and etc. So there are many that do that and have done it through the ages. The problem is that the New Testament never gives a command to make Sunday the new Sabbath. The New Testament never says Sunday now replaces Saturday, or that the Sabbath is moved from the seventh day to the eighth day, or to the first day of the week. And many Messianic Jews say, well, you know, God gave our people the Ten Commandments, and in the Ten Commandments was to honor the Sabbath, which was the seventh day of the week. 6 days you labor, and the seventh day you rest, and it was established at creation. And why should we change it? So there are some Messianic Jews that are in churches, but Saturday is still their Sabbath. They worship on Sunday, but Saturday is their Sabbath day. And there are plenty of others that are in Messianic congregations that set apart the seventh day as the Sabbath, not in a legalistic way, but saying God still calls us to set apart one day in seven, and it was the seventh day that he rested on. And this gives us solidarity with the rest of our Jewish community. This keeps us in the life cycle of the rest of our Jewish community and shows them that you can be Jewish and follow Jesus at the same time. And if you'll read the New Testament, you'll see pretty clearly that that's how the first disciples lived, that the first disciples who were Jewish continued to live as Jews. They may have worshiped the Lord, celebrated his resurrection on Sunday morning or Sunday evening after work, but certainly the Sabbath day, the day of rest, was still the seventh day for them, and many Messianic Jews follow that. But it varies. In my own life, Lewis, I've never felt that Sunday was the Sabbath, that the church had the authority to change from the seventh day to the eighth day. I've never believed that personally, but for much of my life, I've been in church settings where Sunday was set apart, and that was our day of corporate worship, and you know, the day when you didn't do normal work. And then I've been in Messianic congregations, and you know, that was my lifestyle, to worship on Saturday. But to me personally, I still see, when I'm not out ministering and speaking, which I'm often doing on the weekend, then yes, for me, Saturday remains the Sabbath. I don't believe God ever officially changed it to Sunday. At the same time, he never commanded the whole church, you must keep the seventh day Sabbath. Hence the church developing a tradition of setting apart Sunday as the day of worship and celebration of the resurrection of Jesus. Ultimately, even though Romans 14 may not have been initially addressing the issue of the Sabbath, I believe it does apply that every believer must work this out between them and God and not judge others for having differences. Hey, thank you, sir, for the question. 866-34-TRUTH. By the way, YouTube question about someone wanting to learn Hebrew, getting a Zondervan grammar. Yeah, there's some great books, Introduction to Biblical Hebrew, and now they have CDs and things like that, or DVDs, so you can learn and have someone help you with reading or things like that. Yes, there are plenty of good introductory grammars. There's not one in particular that I recommend, but there are lots of ways to learn Hebrew these days, online, other ways. But if you're interested in the language of the Bible, you want to learn Biblical Hebrew. Learning to speak modern Hebrew will not help you tremendously with Biblical Hebrew. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That Hebrew music reminds you that it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. It's also Purim. 866-34-TRUTH. You know, the twists and turns in Jewish histories, the attempt to annihilate the Jews of Europe by Adolf Hitler and his cronies, wiping out two-thirds of European Jews out of the ashes of the Holocaust, has built the modern state of Israel. Then Israel being so threatened by surrounding nations, that seven armies wanted to wipe out Israel in its inception, 1947, 1948, Israel needing to dig deep into resources and learn how to infiltrate other countries and get secret information. And then it ends up leading, because of just the fight for survival, to the Mossad and these other intelligence agencies that Israel has that have been so far above others. It was out of the need to survive. And again, out of what looks like the end comes a new beginning. This is the way it is with Jewish history. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. I'm going to go to the phones in a moment. I'm just looking at a number of comments from a gentleman named Alex on YouTube. I don't normally look at those. Sir, you really need to call the show. You're posting one thing after another, typical anti-Semitic libels, typical anti-Semitic misunderstandings. Again, if you got them from the horrific Marching to Zion video, no surprise there. But let me just note a few of these. You know, you asked, for example, John 8:44, where Jesus says to some of the Jews, "Then you're of your father, the devil." Does that apply to all Jews who don't believe? But it applies to all human beings outside of Jesus. Why single out the Jews? 2 Corinthians 4:4, "The God of this world has blinded the minds of those who don't believe." 1 John 5:19, "We're of God, little children, and the whole world lies under the power of the evil one. We were by nature children of wrath," Ephesians 2. Why single out, "Well, they're just Jews, their father's the devil"? No, if you're outside of Jesus, you're under the power of the evil one. You know, the idea that Christians acting in unchristian ways drove Jewish people away from the gospel. We say, well, listen, God hardened them. Yes, there's been a hardening, and there's been human sin. There's been human sin. Here's someone that's, you know, rejected the gospel, and maybe God's given them over to their sin, and then I treat them in an unchristlike way. I add to that. There is miserable responsibility. You know, another question, well, aren't they hardened against Christ reading the Talmud, which blasphemes him? Listen. You could talk to ultra-Orthodox Jews around the world that learn Talmud, study Talmud day and night, 10, 15 hours a day, and you ask them what they know about Jesus or if they've ever had a lesson about Jesus, probably never have heard a teaching about him. He's completely out of sight, out of mind. And there are in several million words, there are a handful of very negative, ugly references to Jesus in the Talmud, okay? They are completely immaterial to the overall life of someone studying Talmud. And a good friend of mine who's a counter-missionary rabbi has responded to some things I said to make clear. He put out a video making clear, listen, he's, I don't know how old he is now, maybe 50-ish or something like that, or late 40s or something. And he said his whole life in ultra-Orthodox circles, in rabbinic circles, learning, he's never heard a teaching about Jesus. It's completely out of sight, out of mind. So many ridiculous misconceptions. And when Paul writes in Galatians 3 that the promise of the seed, that the seed was Christ, he also knows that the Hebrew word seed, zera, is only used in the singular if it's referring to physical seeds, like planting seeds. So you have singular and plural. Otherwise, you never use the plural. Just like the word offsprings. Do we use offsprings? No, offspring. Offspring is collective. Paul knew it was collective. He was making a polemical point that fulfillment comes to the Messiah. But he is emphatic. He is clear. He is definite that God gave promises to the nation that remain. You have to take it up with Paul. It's not my view. That's why the Jewish people remain to this day. That's why, although we've been scattered, we have been regathered by God. Look, I've put out something very simple for years now. I've put it out in academic debates. I've put it out on radio. I've put it out in social media. I've put it out in writing. I've put it out in video. Not one coherent, biblically-based response have I ever received to this. So I'm going to throw it out again, then I'm going to go to the phones. We know that when God blesses, no one can curse. When he curses, no one can bless. When he opens a door, no one can shut it. When he shuts a door, no one can open it. We know these things. We know that when he scatters, no one can regather. When he regathers, no one can scatter. These are principles that we see based in Deuteronomy and elsewhere in the scriptures. So, very simple question for you. If God, in his wrath, destroyed the temple, which we know he did, and scattered the Jewish people around the world, who regathered us? How is it there are more than 6 million Jews living in Israel today? Who regathered us? You say, well, people just did it. Well, so they overpowered God? They overpowered God's will? Well, Satan did. Oh, Satan's now stronger than God? If he scattered us in his wrath, the only way we're back is because he regathered us. It's very simple. And for those that are very strong in your belief in the sovereignty of God, then you have to say that God has sovereignly raised up the nation again. And by the way, I'm not a dispensationalist. I don't believe in a pre-trib rapture, all right? Professor Craig Keener and I are just finishing our book now, which comes out next year on... I think it comes out next year on Not Afraid of the Antichrist, Why We Don't Believe in a Pre-Trib Rapture. I'm not a dispensationalist, all right? Listen, I can take you back to the Puritans who were expecting the regathering of Israel and the salvation of Israel. They weren't dispensationalists. I can take you to Charles Spurgeon. I can take you to Bishop J.C. Ryle, you know, great Christian leaders in the 1800s, and Robert Murray McShane and Horatius Bonar with their tremendous vision and burden for the salvation of the Jewish people and the regathering of the Jewish people. And Bishop Ryle said that, again, these are, you know, Calvinist preachers and leaders and Presbyterian pastors and Baptist pastors and leaders and luminaries and great thinkers and theologians. Bishop Ryle said, as he understands scriptures, the Jews will be regathered back to the land in unbelief first, and then will come to faith. So this has nothing to do with dispensational beliefs, all right? To me, it's just being scriptural, plain and simple. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Chase in Lusby, Maryland. Thanks, sir, for calling the Line of Fire.
How are you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing well.
All right. I was just asking, you know, about this whole thing with the Marching to Zion by Pastor Stephen Anderson and with all that.
Yeah, horrific anti-Semitic video filled with dangerous misinformation and rhetoric. Yeah, absolutely.
It's very saddening. I just wanted to ask you a question, or just to see if you know, how did these conspiracy theories against the Jewish people came in the first place, or do you know how did it became in the public?
Yeah.
How did it start?
A few things. Number one, Satan. Go back, read Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. You'll see Satan is behind this lie that Jerusalem is always a city of rebellion, that the Jewish people can't be trusted. The fact also that Jewish people live differently, they live by God's laws and therefore differently than the nations, that made them suspect. But the same devil behind Pharaoh is the same devil behind Adolf Hitler, is the same devil behind Haman, wanting to wipe out Jewish people or wanting to wipe out the sons of Israel, etc. So that's one thing. Second thing is, historically, as the Jewish people have lived differently than others in the nations, that always makes you suspect. If something's different, you know, well, where is that? You know, they're very suspect to you. That's another factor. And then in modern times, in the last century plus, there is the notorious Protocols of the Elders of Zion. this we know the origins of. Russian secret police put this together, a document alleging that there was a cabal of 300 Jewish leaders waiting secretly, waiting for the right moment to take over the whole world and then bring the whole world into obedience to the Hindu god Vishnu. I kid you not about the Vishnu part. So the protocols were widely circulated. Oh, they're real. They're in much of the Muslim world, they're still believed as being true. You can go to book vendors, you know, selling books in streets in New York City, and those will sell out all the time. So that's how a lot of the lies were disseminated in modern times. So just look into the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and you'll see. But it's a known forgery. 866-34-TRUTH. When I say forgery, you know, this alleged truthful document, which was originally done by Russian secret police. We know the origins of it. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go back to the phones, let me draw your attention to some recent comments by Louis Farrakhan, a Nation of Islam, a black Muslim leader for many, many years. And Louis Farrakhan has recently said that, you know, he attacks white men again, and he attacks Jews again. So this rhetoric has been ongoing by Louis Farrakhan for decades. He almost died of cancer some years ago. His life has been preserved. Perhaps his life has been preserved because God is still giving him room to repent. Was it last year or before that he made some references to Jesus in a way that would have spoken of familiarity he once may have had with the Lord? May God grant him repentance before it is too late. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Bernice in Orange County, California. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. I have a question about the Book of Esther. I was reading a little bit about the returning of the Jewish community after King Cyrus. And then it says in Ezra 2:2 that it mentioned different names of different people that came back to Jerusalem, and one of them was Mordecai. Is that the same as Esther 2:5, the cousin of Esther? Is that the same character?
Yeah. So you have the same name, but no, there you have no indication that it's the identical time period, or that Mordecai was one of those who did come back. That's certainly not part of the narrative. Now, it's interesting that you have the same name, but you can have the same name and it's not the same person. So the question is the time period exactly the same? That's big question number one. And then question number two, is there any record of Mordecai coming back? And you'd say, well, isn't there in Ezra? The answer would be apparently not. But thank you for asking. Much appreciated.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on the Line of Fire. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. I'm going to go to the phones momentarily. Just another reminder, now is the time to make plans. February of next year is going to be here before you know it. Come on, we're in March already, March 2018. Donald Trump has announced he's running again in 2020. All right, time flies. February 1st through 10th, next year, trip of a lifetime to Israel. Join me there. Go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, to find out more and sign up today. With all these trips, space is always limited, and the earlier you get your deposit in, the better. Also, please be in prayer for me, and if you feel led to help financially, wonderful. Later in May, I've got some unique plans of some Jewish evangelism I'm going to be involved in. Can't say more than that now, but some unique plans for Jewish evangelism. So please be in prayer for me with that. And also, I'm speaking at a very controversial conference very strongly pro-Palestinian kind of Israel-bashing conference, Christ at the Checkpoint. I've been asked to come in and bring a view that's going to be different than most of the other speakers. I want to bring a challenge to the Palestinian Christians there. It's going to be a pretty intense environment because I want to walk in love and speak the truth in an uncompromised way. So remember to pray, and if you want to help with expenses involved in that, going to Israel, and then aside from that, a special Jewish outreach I'll be involved in, just go to our website, askdrbrown.org, click on donate. Your gift, large or small, is greatly appreciated. Lastly, remember you can still pre-order a signed, numbered copy of Playing with Holy Fire, a wake-up call to the Charismatic Pentecostal Church. We've gotten a great response already, advanced response for this book. There's real interest in it. I pull no punches. It's full of encouragement and truth, but I pull no punches. And you'll want to get this book out to as many people as you can. So you can still get collector's edition. It is signed. It is numbered with a scripture verse for you. And I have the joy of signing it to you. You get these special books. It helps with our ministry work as well. You can find out about that on my website. So all at askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Let's go to Ian in Fort Worth, Texas. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. real quick before my question, I just wanted to thank you for a comment that you made. I'm Reformed, and I do believe that Israel coming back to their land is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I've always found inconsistent amongst what I've noticed a lot of Presbyterians is that, you know, that they don't believe that. But you had said, you know, shouldn't they at least acknowledge that, you know, God's sovereignty and his providence brought them back? Because it wouldn't make any sense. Like, oh, wow, it's just a coincidence. That just doesn't.
Yeah, why did God sovereignly do something that is the exact opposite of what you would expect him to do if, in fact, Israel as a nation no longer has significance in the sight of God? Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And look, for me, I look back to some of the great Presbyterian leaders that inspired my own life. I mentioned a number of them, and the Puritans from whom I've learned so much. And so many of them had a tremendous heart for Israel. Samuel Rutherford, whose writing Spurgeon deeply prized as among the most spiritual writings in existence. According to Rutherford, he would put off going to heaven and being with Jesus if he could be here to see the Jewish people and Jesus the Messiah reconciled. That's how much he loved Israel and the Jewish people. But yeah, great. As to your question, sir.
My question was, now I do believe, like I said, that the Bible predicts, you know, the Jews coming back to the land, but I've heard interpretations of Isaiah 11:11, where it says that he will gather them a second time.
Yeah.
Some people say that that's him talking about, you know, first time was in Egypt, second time was the Babylonian captivity and bringing them back. And then the other, of course, is the first is Babylonian captivity. And then the second is what happened here recently.
Right. We do know there are other passages, for example, such as Jeremiah 16, where it says that with the regathering that's going to happen in the future, initially speaking of the Babylonian exile, that it's going to be so great that you'll forget about the return from Egypt, right? The difference there is that the scattering it speaks of from all around the world was greater than the Babylonian exile. So the Babylonian exile only fulfills these types of passages in part. Here, in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, verse 10, who shall stand as a banner to the people, for the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. Well, this all happens way after the Babylonian exile, right? It shall come to pass in that day. So these are the days of the Messianic era. These are the days in which the Gentiles are looking to the Messiah. So it can't be referring to Babylonian exile only. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Patros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. So that full scattering had not happened. The islands of the sea and all these distant coastlands, that had not happened in the Babylonian exile. So it is either referring to Babylonian exile and the future, or if it's Egypt, and then the Babylonian exile is the beginning of the world exile, okay? And there's this massive exile which has continued through the centuries because there was never a full regathering from Babylon, only partial. So the full regathering is still something we're watching happen, and then will come to its conclusion when the Messiah returns. Otherwise, the passages are exaggerated by the prophets because the Jewish people were not that scattered at the time of the Babylonian exile, but they have been that scattered through history. And therefore, to me, the only legitimate view is that there is still a regathering that is future. Look at the promises, for example, in Ezekiel 36 and ask, were these fulfilled with the return of the Jews from Babylon? No, they weren't. Therefore, that promise remains to be fulfilled. Thank you, sir. Great question. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Michael in Los Angeles. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown, for taking my call. I just want to ask you, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in the first century Jewish, when the apostles were alive, can you tell me how their daily activity was during Sabbath days in comparison to the Jewish today? And also,
yeah.
If you would compare that Sabbath day and the first day, which is Sunday, in terms of they were engaged in their activity in terms of teaching, mm-hmm. and taking care of the other Christians or in the community in general.
Yeah, all right. So, thank you. Number one, we don't know exactly. We cannot say for sure what first century Jewish practice was among the apostles and the first Jewish followers of the Messiah. We know certain things, you know, that there were travel restrictions because Acts 1 mentions a Sabbath day's journey. We know that there was not normal work that was done. We know that there was gathering in the synagogues, but we know that there are differences in the different Jewish groups. And then many of the traditions we have come later, so we don't know exactly. There's dispute in some of the Dead Sea Scroll documents about different aspects of Sabbath law. But what was presupposed was that they were not working, that it was a sacred day for the Lord, that the travel was limited, and that there was attendance in synagogue or prayers at the temple. So that much we do know, and that would be self-evident, you know, with the apostles going into the synagogue on the Sabbath, and they're obviously welcomed as fellow Jews. And we know Peter going to the temple at the time of prayer. That's just a daily thing. So there was a Jewish lifestyle that they still lived by as Jews living in that community. Now, it appears that by the end of the first century, you have evidence of believers gathering either early Sunday morning, because Sunday was a work day, early Sunday morning or Sunday after work to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. Acts 20 is debated. Is it referring to Saturday night or Sunday night? Depends if it's a Jewish calendar versus a Roman calendar. All right. But we don't know a lot about this. It's several centuries before the church makes some statement about changing the Sabbath to Sunday. Nobody is thinking in those terms, okay? Either it was just understood the seventh-day Sabbath is given to Israel, or Christians would enter in and enter into that rest, you know, the fulfillment being found in Jesus on a daily basis, etc. But there was no notion that Sunday had become the Sabbath in the early church. All right, this is centuries before this happens. So all we can tell, the best evidence that we have, is that by the end of the first century, there were some believers gathering to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus before or after work on a Sunday, but it was not the day of rest. The day of rest, the Sabbath, again, no normal work, limited travel, prayers in the synagogue or in the temple. These would be the normal activities. Beyond that, we can only speculate is exactly how they live. By the way, Todd, sorry I can't get to your question today and other questions. Sorry we can't get to everyone. But was Lucifer an archangel? I know of nothing that explicitly says that. And the text that we would look to for the most information would be Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14. But he was certainly highly prominent when he was Hillel ben Shachar, Shining One, Son of Dawn, which in Latin becomes Lucifer, Light Bearer, which then gets used as a title for Satan. Hey, friends, may I ask you to pray for the salvation of the lost sheep of the house of Israel? Whatever your own theological viewpoint about the end times and various theological questions having to do with the Jewish people, I hope you recognize with me that Jewish people need Jesus like everyone else. Pray that their eyes and hearts would be open to Yeshua. And pray for me and our team that we'll effectively be able to reach many Jewish people with the good news of the Messiah. Thanks for joining us today. Change the world.